This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. On January 1st each year, published works enter the public domain after their copyrights expire. Geeks worldwide celebrate this as Public Domain Day. It means that works can freely be shared, downloaded, screened, and digitalized. So how many of these works entered the public domain this year in the U.S.? Zero. In fact, no published work will enter the public domain in this country until 2019. In the past century, Congress has continually strengthened copyright law so that now it takes longer for published material to enter the public domain. Critics say these newest stringent rules are downright punitive.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
Yeah, and in fact, Dr. Seuss's Grinch Who Stole Christmas would be in the public domain right now were it not for the tougher rules. James Boyle is here. He's a law professor at Duke University and co-founder of the Center for the Study of Public Domain. Welcome back, Jamie. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So what would have entered? Give us a sense of the number of publications that would have entered the public domain this year.
Well, the number is enormous. Back in 1976, you got 28 years of copyright, and then you could extend that for another 28. And 93% of books didn't renew. It wasn't worth it. 85% of all works. So if you imagine a world where basically about 90% of all culture went into the public domain immediately, so there would be this torrent of works entering the public domain. And of course, you know, that's not happening. The famous ones, you mentioned The Grinch Stole Christmas. There's also The Cat in the Hat would have been in the public domain today. Endgame, Samuel Beckett. Atlas Shrugged, interestingly. Curious George gets a medal. And these are the famous works. But there would have been countless millions of lesser-known works and works that are likely to remain lesser-known because we don't have adequate access to them.
Well, look, I mean, here's the thing. Copyright protects intellectual property. People create this stuff on the hope and the promise that they will profit by their work. Why should it be free for us after 28 years?
Well, I think the first thing is the first reason why it might be free is if I say to you, you know, Frank, will you write a book? I'll give you 28 years and another 28 if you want it. And you say, sure, I like that deal, Jamie. I'll do it. I think it's not seemly after the 56 years to say, actually, I'd like to renegotiate that deal. I'd rather have life plus 70. So that's the first reason. The second reason, I think, is that creators themselves have built on the work of the past. I mean, if the number of writers who've stolen from Shakespeare were to be counted up, it would be a large one. Shakespeare himself stole profligately from his contemporaries in ways that would, in fact, be copyright infringement today. So the second thing is actually, it's not a zero-sum game. Writers are getting something out of the public domain, not just giving to it.
And you give us that law again, zero plus, end plus, right? The end of their life plus 70 years, right?
Life plus 70 yeah. If you're a human being with a copyright, 95 years if you're a corporation yeah. with a copyright. So, I mean, one way of looking at this is when Jefferson, who helped to inspire the intellectual property laws that this nation has. When Jefferson or Madison looked around their contemporaries, they could confidently assume that books that they wrote, that their friends wrote, would be in the public domain during their lifetime. No human being alive today will, unless there's a conscious decision taken by one of his or her contemporaries, find a work that is in the world right now, free to use, to remake, to adapt, to make an opera out of, to digitize. Like, that won't happen. If I choose, sure, I can dedicate it. I can put it under Creative Commons license. But absent that, all this stuff will go into copyright, including informal culture, including the home movies, the diaries. All of this stuff is sucked into copyrights like a black hole and doesn't get out. And the sad thing is the goal of copyright is to encourage dissemination. It's not just to reward people. It's to reward producers and distributors so that we get more stuff. But we actually are getting less stuff.
Well, but just because it's copyrighted doesn't mean I can't use it. I just go pay for the rights and then go use it, right?
Excellent idea. And would that were true. If that were true, I would be much less upset by this. Most of the material we're talking about is commercially unavailable. And in many cases, actually the majority, for example, in film, it's an orphan work. We don't know who the copyright holder is. So not only is it not commercially available, there is no person or company who you can pay to get to use it. And this is the most perverse of all because this stuff is locked up and no one benefits from it.
How is that possible? How does it work?
Well, there's nothing that lawyers can't do if you put their mind to it. Copyright's a strict liability system, which means that being a nice person or trying, you know, assiduously to find out whether something's in the public domain, that's not a defense. And so as a result, we have all of these moldering movies sitting in our great libraries that, you know, the archivists won't show to you because it, you know, I don't think there's no one out there who I can actually find, but I don't know, and I could be sued. And it's just sad because this is the moment when we have the technology to actually make this stuff available to the world.
What about the big production houses, the big movie houses or publishing houses that do have all of – they own these copyrights to stuff that they have no interest in distributing anymore? What rights do we have there, and isn't there some way to access the stuff?
Well, if it is actually firmly owned by someone who is a commercial entity, then actually, funnily enough, that's probably the best case situation. We do have empirical studies that show that actually the material that gets made available, you would think it's if like, okay, I've got the rights. Oh, I'll put it out on DVD. I'll put it out on Netflix. You know, like why not, right? I mean, I've got it in my backlist. It actually turns out that it's the public domain stuff that is put out much faster. The hobbyist, the weird old guy, you know, out there in Utah with an internet connection who, I just love this movie. I want to put it up there. I mean, that would be great. But the sad thing is in many cases, either they don't own it or they don't know that they own it. One funny story to talk about how the movie companies use their backlist. I don't know if you remember the movie, the oldest Frankenstein movie, that glorious black and white sort of silent movie. There, at the end, there's the bonfire. The villagers are coming. Frankenstein is at bay. The flickering flames, that was them burning all of their priceless masters of their black and white movies. They're like, hey, let's make a bonfire. They were actually burning our cultural heritage.
Wow. Well, and I guess that's the point is what do you think? What is it that we're losing by not having access to this stuff?
Well, the difficult thing is we're not fully sure because we don't have access to it. The first thing I think is we digitize it and make it available. There's stuff in there that people would love, that they would remake, that they would work into other things. Look at what Shakespeare did with all of the stuff around him. Look at what musicians have always done. I mean, music is really subject to this. You know, if you took classical composers and subjected them to the same rules we have today, many of the things that they did would not be acceptable. Scholarship. I mean, Google Books has gone some way to do this. We can go back and look at word frequency. We can look, when did the word feminism start being used? What about the word public domain? What about the word neoliberalism? Like, look at frequency. Look at all of those things. That's much harder to do because of this. Not impossible. The judge said that there was a fair use for Google to do that. So there are still holes in copyright that allow these kinds of uses. But the answer is we don't know what we could get out of it precisely because we're forbidden from trying.
So who's profiting by this? I mean, clearly, this is why the Ayn Rand, or Ayn Rand as I prefer, would have loved this, you know, because she gets to, or somebody gets to own it privately for a long, long time. But the suggestion is that somebody would also profit by this. So are they? Is there some profit? Is there money to be made by these extended copyright restrictions?
For a very, very, very tiny, tiny number of copyright holders, yes. So the perennial favorite, you know, the Ayn Rand, the, you know, J.K. Rowling will be making, or its heirs will be making a lot of money hundreds, you know, years from now. The sad thing is if we just had a system where you had to opt in, where you actually had to be around and say, it's my work and I want to continue to get copyright, we'd probably get about 98% of the works going into the public domain. So just by that simple measure. So in other words, everyone who is profiting would still profit,
right,
but we would have the public domain. That's the tragedy here.
You would think it's worth renewing, or your heirs or the corporation's heirs, and they could say, yes, we're renewing, and everything else that nobody really cares about goes into the public domain. And as you suggested, I think this is the other side of it. I mean, Shakespeare did not make up, as far as I know, there was not a single plot that he didn't take from somebody else. I don't think there's a single original plot, right? All of them are remakes of stuff that was either ancient or contemporary. And yet nobody doubts that his work is utterly original, and it's his work survives and theirs didn't, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting if you look back at the practices of the past, the cultural practices, Shakespeare's, look at the jazz. I mean, under the way that we look at intellectual property now, I don't know if Charlie Parker would have got to make those solos. Wait a minute. You're using somebody else's tune without permission? Like, who gave you permission to do that solo? That seems ludicrous, but that's only because we've got Shakespeare. We've got jazz. The question is, going forward, what will we not have and never know we have lost because we're locking things up.
There's a lot of tension over this, though, in the public domain. We see a lot more activism around a Creative Commons. Wikipedia does exist and it's robust. We have corporations like Red Hat that survive on open source software and learn and can make a profit. So is there a tension? Is there kind of a foot race between the impulse to lock everything up, this old, very old industrial model of copyright, and a kind of a new age of information model?
I think there definitely is. And I think the wonderful thing about the internet is it's sort of an existence proof. You know, if your theory is all swans are white and like five black swans fly overhead, you have to rethink. The internet shows us there are multiple ways of incentivizing creativity and multiple ways of disseminating it. And so it's not that the old model is wrong. It's that the old model is limited. And so the question is, are we going to embrace that and say, We should be humble about how best to encourage creativity and disseminate it. Let's experiment. Or are we going to say, we don't like you competing with our old business model. We want to make you illegal. That's the race that's going on right now. And the danger is that we strike at the technology because it is used to develop a kind of creativity in ways that we don't like.
This January, of course, is the one-year anniversary of Aaron Swartz's death. What role did he play in this fight, and how is his legacy, do you think, playing out these days?
Aaron was a friend of mine. Aaron was a genius. And people in eulogies, they always say, oh, this person could have changed the world. And this person is so – and, you know, of course, we always exaggerate the gifts of the departed. In Aaron's case, there's no exaggeration. He was the first time I saw him, he was 15. His backpack was larger than he was, as far as I could tell, and he'd just basically come up with a coding schema which would allow Creative Commons to put machine-readable licenses online. And I said, we've got a 15-year-old helping us? He said, yeah, this is the world's leading expert. I thought they were joking. He actually was. Aaron was impatient, and in the end, that's what doomed him. He wanted a different world. He imagined a different world. It seemed so logical to him, and he fought really hard to bring it about. And old fogies like me, well, we say that's unwise because we get to write the history books, and so we label people like him unwise. But maybe it's us.
Well, is he right in the long run? I mean, is there a way in which this model really has to change? Is it unsustainable to go on, or can we you know, limp along like this for decades to come?
There's no ineluctable history here. We're not guaranteed it. The internet isn't something that will stay the way it is, right? There are, you know, if Facebook becomes the portal through which everyone perceives the world, if we continue to lock up technologies, if we get rid of net neutrality, you know, these are all fights. And they're basically fights that people have to educate themselves about and come to an informed opinion. Not necessarily mine, I hasten to add, but an opinion, because this stuff is important.
Well, and you need a kind of architecture, not only the technological architecture, but a kind of legal framework. And there again, I think Aaron was important. I mean, in writing the Creative Commons license, I mean, here's somebody who got at least – tell us about that. Tell us about his contribution in that regard.
Well, the idea was that the people who wanted to be able to share their works with the world would be able to say, here's my work. Here are the freedoms I wish affirmatively grant you. You can copy it just for non-commercial purposes. Or, you know, I don't mind if you make a derivative work, but give me attribution. Tell me, you know, say I wrote it. We wanted to make that so that not just human beings could understand it, which was hard enough because we had to change from legal readable to human readable, but we wanted computers to be able to read it. So that if you search Google and you go into the permissions to say, I want something which is tagged to be used for non-commercial purposes, it's something used in full, you can find that if you dig into the Google advanced search page. That's because of what Aaron and a bunch of other people wrote the software code to put on top of the legal code that Larry Lessig and I and others put together to basically say, this is the license by which I say, I want to share.
And his fight with JSTOR, again, now we're talking about intellectual property in the world of in the academy, being able to freely share the work that you all do.
Yes. Aaron was a great believer that we should have wider access to scholarly materials. When I sit at my desk at Duke has a fabulous library system and great electronic permissions. And because I'm coming from a Duke IP address, I can get lots and lots of journals. But the point was, Aaron said, I want that to be available to the smart person in Nigeria, to the smart person in Poland, because they might be smarter than you. They might be able to do better things than it. And that should be possible, particularly for stuff that is generated with public research dollars, particularly for stuff that's in the public domain. And he wanted to make that possible. The exact details of the controversy are murky, and we may never fully know what happened. But that's what he was trying to do.
Well, and also, if you think about that, I mean, a corollary to that is not only should it be available to those researchers in Nigeria and Poland, but very likely your research is about Nigeria and it, or some nation who doesn't necessarily trade in English as their first language. And if all the research is written in English and locked up in JSTOR, the people you wrote about never get to see what you found.
I mean, for myself, very selfishly, I shared my book, The Public Domain, which is online. You can download it for free. It's on Yale University Press. They allowed me to do it. I said very selfishly I shared it because I have discovered so much more about what I wrote about because people have downloaded it, people have translated it, people have read it, people have written to me. It was the most selfish thing I did was to give it away for free.
Also, we didn't talk about the digital world, you know, these changes that are taking place because the technology is changing. But the other side of that is we're seeing more and more software developers and makers now are moving to license, to putting their product on the cloud. So there's no more tangible media and we'll always license and rent and never own. And so it'll never be ours. And we'll always be sort of in this position of having somebody else own the property that we need, that we have to use. Is that dangerous?
It's very dangerous. My dystopia is that one day your grandchild is going to turn to you and say, "Granddad, did anyone ever own books?" Rather than just, you know, licensing them from Amazon or from whomever, from iTunes, so that your books can disappear if your provider goes away. Your books are constantly monitored so people know, wow, he spent a lot of time on that passage of Lady Chatterley's Lover. You know, he keeps rereading it, you know. It's like, I don't want to live in that world. There's a lot that is great about the idea that this is my book. I bought it. I can give it to Frank. I can discuss it. I can give it away and give it to the library. We're in danger of losing that freedom. Yes, we need to protect authors, publishers, and digital media presents challenges, but we're moving too quickly to basically get rid of the I own my books model.
Well, and publishers and newspapers and all of those industries and even the record industry was able to get along pretty well, even though I was able to hand my record to someone else, they could record it. I mean, we did all these things with more primitive technology. Those industries thrived.
The counter-argument you will hear, which has truth to it, is yes, but digital copies are perfect and they can go everywhere. My market could be destroyed by a single copy. The truth is more complex. It turns out that a lot of people are perfectly willing to pay from the authorized source, that there are still people who go and buy music on iTunes even though they can download it for free, that Nine Inch Nails had one of the best-selling MP3 album of the year a couple of years ago, and they made it available freely under a Creative Commons license. People went out and bought. It's complicated is the answer, and that's our public policy debates on everything don't deal well with complicated stuff. People want simple answers.
That is why the other crazy thing that happens, people who donate to public radio, which they could also get for free, understand that the complicated conversation will happen here. That's why it's worth paying for.
I would agree entirely.
Would that there were an 800 number I could give out right now. Jamie, it is always such a great pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Jamie Boyle, law professor at Duke University, co-founder of the Center for the Study of the Public Domain. Coming up next, disgust, that icky feeling, how it serves us and how it just might not. Stay tuned.